Yeah, I suppose why I find this interesting is because I'm at a particular stage in my relationship to the order, where in a way I'm reassessing what it is, because I'm not clear about what that relationship is. I think this is because for most of my life I've lived in communities. I've been very much involved in setting up centres, both this country and in the States and in Spain, and, well, working in centres in Spain. So I've been working very much within the institutions of the movement, and I've had particular roles in the movement. But now I've withdrawn from a lot of, well, all of those, pretty much. And I think those gave me some kind of shape of my relationship to the order. And so now, when I don't have those things, I'm having to re-ask what that relationship is. It's also fairly complicated by the fact that the order that I joined was 45. I joined it 45 or more, no, 45 years ago. So it was a very different, the manifestation was very different. And, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on communities, setting up right livelihoods, running centres, expanding the movement. That was pretty much everybody involved had signed up for that approach. Whereas now it's very, very different, of course. It's much, much broader. People are doing all sorts of different things, living different kinds of lifestyles. And so it's not so easy to feel kind of identified with the practicalities. So what that means is that one has to go a little bit deeper. And, you know, I mean, the kind of standard answer to that is that we're all going for refuge to the three jewels. The way I'm sort of experiencing at the moment, though, I recently went to a weekend for those order members who've been ordained by Bante.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I'm aware I'm in this process of reassessing what is my relationship to the order and so on. And going on that, I thought, well, you know, I'll meet these old friends and so on, and maybe I'll get a real sense of kind of connecting with them in some way. But I didn't, because there's such a variety of people, of lifestyles there, that what I had to fall back on in the end was this definition that Bante's given of the order, that we're disciples of him, disciples of Sangharakshita. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite happy with that. I mean, I was happy with that beforehand. So that's really kind of what I fall back on. And how that's going to actually shape itself in more practical terms is at the moment unknown to me. You know, I feel like I'm having to rediscover the kind of the manifestation of my relationship to the order. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I'm interested in where your strongest heart connections in the order are.
Well, the strongest is definitely with Bante.
Yeah.
You know, undoubtedly. I've got a lot of... I've got a lot of friends in the order. But again, one of the things, because I'm currently living on a boat and I'm travelling around, I'm moving around. So I've got this kind of wandering lifestyle. Mm. At times it feels a bit kind of lonely. I'm missing something.
Mm.
I've lived nearly all my life in communities. So I've had people around me. And now I don't. So I've been aware that I don't have a kind of an immediate social circle.
Mm.
I don't have family around me. I don't have much of a family that I'm in contact with anymore, since my parents died and I'm an only child. Don't have a wife, don't have children, don't have any of those kind of connections. And also, I don't have a kind of an immediate social circle. I don't have people that I meet, you know, who live just down the road or even who go to the same centre as me.
Mm.
You know, I don't have those kind of social circle of friends. I know a lot of people that I've known for a long time in the order. But none of them are kind of friends in that ordinary sense, you know, people that you hang out with on a sort of daily or weekly basis.
None of them?
Not really. You know, it's sort of, I'm trying to figure out how to express this, because it's a new sort of, it's like I belonged to a community of people with whom I share my spiritual ideals, and I do have a strong heart connection with them. Mm. But that's kind of, it's different, I think, from having a local belonging to, having a particular close circle of friends. I'm aware that a lot of this I'm talking about, I'm not expressing it very clearly, even from my own point of view. But
it's in process, isn't it?
It is a process, yeah.
Because
yeah.
What I'm hearing you say is that, you know, for most of your adult life, you've been in those contexts, in the communities, creating things, and in a way the work that you've done has been the context, and that's been the connections. And there was this big change when you came to look after your dad.
Yeah.
And now it's the phase after that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Something I'm interested to throw in was talking to Marlini and Ananda earlier. We realised that all of them and Dharmapala had all had a time when they'd stepped out or moved away. Or, you know, Ananda often talks about how he kind of left Ariyatara in the 70s and went and did his own thing. Mm-hmm. Marlini said several times about how she had to go to New Zealand and she kind of went off and her life kind of re-evolved. And obviously Dharmapala left the order and then rejoined it. And so we've just got quite interested in that. And you're just struck with you talking about kind of going off on your own on your boat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying there's a direct parallel between them, but I'm interested in the... There's a phase, then there's a kind of a going off, and then there's a kind of a reassessment, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I think the boat is part of the reassessment. I don't think it's part of the going off. The going off, if anything, was looking after my dad so that all my emotional energy went into caring for him. That was the sort of biggest departure, if you like, that I've made from being totally involved in the movement.
And did you see looking after your dad as part of your practice?
Well, I mean, everything's part of your practice, isn't it?
Mm.
I didn't see it as sort of a specific practice. No, I mean, you know, you live your life and you do your practice in your life, whatever it is. So I didn't think it was a particularly conducive context.
Mm.
You know, I didn't think it was an easy context. Yeah. But I mean, you carry on with your practice, don't you?
Mm.
So as I say, isn't it? You practice in whatever you find, whatever situation you find yourself in. And some contexts are very supportive to that practice and some aren't. And I don't particularly think looking after my dad was supportive to my spiritual practice.
Do you think can you see ways in which it changed it?
I think it made me appreciate the difficulties that people have who have children, what they face. Because, you know, I was very emotionally engaged with my father during that period. It was a six-year period. And, you know, I would imagine that people are very strongly emotionally engaged with their children. And I found it very difficult to get engaged with other things when I was engaged with him. It was almost like he was a sort of magnet that drew my emotional attention all the time. So it's actually quite difficult to do anything else. And I would imagine it's like that with children. So I kind of quite admired people who have children who still manage to do other things as well. That was one thing I learned. This, you know, this question about friends and personal connections. I think spiritual friendships are of a different nature to ordinary friendships. And in some ways, I think one sacrifices or renounces a lot of ordinary friendship in order to develop spiritual friendships.
How would you define ordinary friendship? Or a bit of it that you sacrifice?
Well, what I'm thinking about here is there's a few songs of Milarepa, where Milarepa is talking about the disadvantages of friends and family, and how, you know, it's good to renounce friends and family. And so I think it's renouncing friends and family are people with whom you have a certain kind of emotional connection that does actually bind you to them. So, you know, there's all the warmth and, you know, the love of family and friends, but there's an emotional bondage that goes on within that context. Now, what I feel that I've done in my involvement with the movement is that I've moved away from those kind of friendships. The friendships that I've developed, I don't feel so bound up with. You know, I can be with somebody that I haven't seen for 2 or 3 years, feel a very kind of an intimate connection, and then they leave, and that's fine. You know, it doesn't hurt in a way. And so that I feel I've got that kind of friendship spread. Those friends are spread all over the world. But that's different from this more secure circle of social friendship. Maybe that's the distinction between social friendship, who are people that are around you that provide you with some sort of sense of belonging and security. And then there's the kind of spiritual friends, which are people that support your desire to be independent of those kind of friendships. I think it's along those lines I'm sort of getting towards. And, you know, sometimes, particularly when you're getting older, you're sort of wondering where those friends, the secure friends and family are. And you have to think, well, actually, no, I don't have them. You know, I've in a way renounced that for these other kind of spiritually supported friendships, which are of a different nature. So those spiritual friends provide spiritual support, but not social security. It may be, of course, that you have friends that are both spiritual friends and, as it were, social friends. That's also possible.
Well, I'm thinking about conditionality in this, and if you're living in a place alongside a bunch of people in the same sangha for a long time, does that not provide the conditions whereby you do get both?
I think you do, yeah. Yeah, so if you're living in a community or living in the same geographical area, yeah, you would get that. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I'm not doing that now. I've moved away from that. And there is an added degree of freedom in that independence. But of course, freedom means less security. I think all those things always go together. You know, if you want to be free, then you have to give up security.
Yeah.
So, in terms of friendships, I think your spiritual friends enable you to be free while still having sort of intimate connections with other human beings. But they don't necessarily provide you with the same kind of security that you previously had. I mean, I'm exploring this whole area, so it sort of may not sound very clear.
I think it does sound clear, because I think you've described how you've been in very particular contexts where those, you know, like we say, those conditions have been strong and they've been a particular strong kind of connection. Mm-hmm. And there's a depth there which, like you say, you can go away, not see each other for ages, and you can reconnect. Mm-hmm. And now you're going off and doing a thing on your own. And you've just been in quite particular conditions. It's not like, you know, you've decided to come and live in Bristol.
Right.
Where you have got quite a few connections, which mm-hmm. potentially could be more like that, if that was what you wanted, but that may not be. So, you know, it's like, is that what you're looking for? And what's it time for? I mean, that's the that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because what it's time for when you're 40, 50, 60, and what's time for when you're 70, 80. Can I throw in a question?
Yeah.
A question Vidya Mala definitely wanted us to include in this is, what does going for refuge to the three jewels mean to you? It's maybe quite interesting to throw that in at this juncture.
That's an enormous question, isn't it?
Has it changed over time?
No, it hasn't. And I know this because something that was very important to me, actually, about 5 years ago, I listened to a video recording of an interview that Surya Prabha did with me 25 years ago, about a period 15 years before that. So I got these three snapshots, sort of now, 25 years ago, and 40 years ago. And I would, on each of those occasions, I would have answered the same questions in the same way. So it sort of, it put me in touch with a kind of current, a current running through my being, which has always been there and has always been very strong. And that, in a way, started a bit even before I met Bhante. I think I had some kind of insight. Something happened that I knew was important. I knew it was to do with the nature of the mind, and I couldn't identify it. I didn't know what it was. Have you heard me? Have I said this before? Yeah. So, do you want me to repeat that? Yeah. So it was. There was a very cloudy awareness of something that was really important. When I met Bhante, almost immediately, within the first week of being around him on a retreat, I realised that he knew what that was all about. He was the first person I've met. I really felt confident that he knew that was what that was about. He articulated it. Really clearly. He had a series of practices, meditation practices, ethical practices, views that supported that experience. He linked it in with the Buddhist tradition. So I made the connection with Buddhism, that Buddhism was about the development of this, whatever it was. And also around him, there was a community of people who shared that same vision. So there for me was what the three jewels was. And I realized that at the time. So the Buddha was this sort of something that I connected with. The Buddha represented that. It was something to do with the nature of the mind and so on. The Dharma was the teachings that he gave that sort of supported that, practice, the views that supported it, the lifestyles that supported it, all of the kind of supportive conditions to help both deepen and connect with and deepen that experience. And then the spiritual community, the Sangha, was those people that were around that shared that. So that was pretty clear to me very early on. And later on, actually, well, about 20 years ago, well, 2000s, around then, I realised that this was the crucial essence of my relationship to Bhante. Bhante had sort of articulated, clarified, and contextualised that experience, and therefore, and had given me the confidence to pursue it. And pursue it, I have done, and it's created a life with which I'm very satisfied. So I'm very grateful to him. And that's to me what Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha really mean. There's an experience that, to call it that, that everybody can have that is of profound value. I see it in terms of a liberating experience. It liberates me from everything, you know, from confusion, from anxiety, from feeling that life is pointless. It provides me with that. Further on, after going, particularly when I was living at Gihiloka, I also realised that I wanted to live a life of the mind, a life sort of that revolved around sort of exploring and understanding my own mind, you know, through reading, through literature, through poetry, through writing, through meditation. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to pursue that. So I've always been interested on in spiritual, I suppose on a kind of rather personal, maybe even selfish sort of level, rather than so much in building institutions and so on. However, when you find something that you really value, you want to share it with people. So at the same time, not only did I want to develop contexts which would enable me to live the kind of life that I wanted, but I also wanted to be able to share it with other people. So I wanted to create those kind of opportunities for other people to partake of that life as well. So that I would see as the sort of work of the Sangha.
So would you say that was what led you to go to America?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, I mean, some other factors, like ambition, wanting to do something with my life that was notable.
Hmm.
And, I wanted to build the movement. I wanted my own patch as well. I wanted to do it, you know, in my own territory, in my own way. So the, you know, other not quite so positive motivations. But yeah, I wanted to share it.
Mm.
Yeah. Still do.
What does that look like now, wanting to share it?
Well, at the moment, it consists really of the time I've experienced my connection with that insight most deeply are when I've been on retreat, and particularly long retreats, particularly because long retreats mean that you can actually go away from the world, and a lot of the kind of the noise of the world, all one's kind of desires and ambitions and activities and involvements, emotional relationships, and all of those things can be left behind. And you just start to experience a kind of a space. And in that space, you can experience this sort of depth, putting it very crudely. So that context is long retreats. So what I want to do now is create a kind of a culture of long retreats, so that people will go on them and experience, hopefully, these, you know, their own depths,
hmm.
in a way. And I'm also quite interested in them being, I've called them sort of Vihara style retreats. So they're not teaching retreats. They're not retreats in which people are going to be taught anything. The assumption is that they've already got, they know what they want to do. They've got their own sort of practice. However, it will be a community. So we will be talking to each other. We will be supportive of each other. But the idea is that you get a small group of people who are mutually supportive, for each to develop their own particular strand and direction in the practice that they want to do.
Mm.
So, you know, somebody may be at a phase where they really want to develop tranquility, so they put a lot of effort to that. Somebody else may be wanting to really sort of develop their visualization practice, their sort of the connection with the ideal, so they can do that. But we can be together as a community, doing slightly different things maybe, but nonetheless sort of, because we've got a common language, a common set of practices, we'd be able to understand each other and mutually support each other.
Mm. So something that interests me in that is what you were saying about people, is not a context in which people would be receiving teachings because they'd already know what they want to do.
Yeah.
And it's an area that interests me in terms of Bhante's, Bhante's vision of what an order member is. Because I'd be interested in your take on this. My sense is that a lot of the model that Bhante had was, by the time you join the order, you kind of know what you're doing, and then it unfolds from there without the need for much more teaching and input. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Well, that's definitely been my experience.
Hmm.
You know, it's sort of... I've been really interested in following strands that have come up in my own practice, both ethical and meditation practice. I mean, for example, when we get ordained, we get given a particular yidam, particular meditation practice, visualization practice. I chose Padmasambhava. And Bhante just said, well, I don't have a practice for Padmasambhava, make one up. So I just made one up. I don't think you do that nowadays, but so I made one up, and it developed. And then over the years, after about sort of 15 years, it had developed into a pretty sort of substantial form. And then I discovered that this was a traditional Tibetan form. You know, so I thought, well, look, there's something in that Tibetan form that is kind of universal, and that if you start, you know, pursuing it, it leads you in that direction. But I'm glad I came to it by myself in a way, rather than trying to sort of do it according to a particular teaching later on. Because it was just very real, you know, I knew exactly what it was all about and so on, because it had come from my own experience. And, I was trained as a scientist, and scientists like to explore the world. They like to find out new things about it. Okay, they do study other people's work, but they also, which I did also, I mean, I would, you know, I'm very appreciative of reading Bhante's books and studying his seminars and all the rest of it, and other people as well, and other traditions as well. But eventually they're all kind of informing my own sort of line of practice. We've got this idea, haven't we, of sort of discovering the guru within, the teacher within. And it's, although it's kind of, you know, there's all sorts of dangers in that teaching. Because you can discover the sort of the overt hedonist within and start following that instead. But if you're careful, you can find an intuition that's leading you in a particular direction.
Mm-hmm.
Another, one of Bhante's things is sort of more and more of less and less, isn't it? So I really don't think you need to learn lots and lots and lots and lots of different things. It's just finding the things that are really important and then practicing them, pursuing them.
I think one of the things that interests me, and you said you just used the word intuitive, is that I do get the sense that intuition is a significant factor in Bhante's presentation of Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be fair to say he's an intuitive thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of interested in the fact that some of us have a much stronger intuition faculty than others. You know, it's one of those Jungian polarities in mm-hmm. intuition and sensing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got quite interested in what it's like for somebody who's much more, who doesn't have such a strong intuition and that sense of something emerging from within. Which, I mean, the sense of something that emerges from within is also profoundly Blakean, isn't it? And I think you can really see Blake's
mm-hmm.
influence on Bhante in that, and the whole mm-hmm. thing about the imagination being the whole man and all of that. But I just wondered if that was something you've ever thought about.
What the...
That not everybody's that intuitive.
No, possibly I haven't. No, I mean, I must say, I think one of my failings, which my friends have pointed out, is that I'm not always sensitive to other people's, the fact that other people don't see things the same way as me. And I think I have sort of perhaps assumed, maybe not so much now, but in the past, that, you know, people do tend to think the same way as me. And consequently, a lot of the times they just don't understand quite what I'm talking about.
Mm. Mm. I think I was interested because I can see what a beautifully strong kind of meeting there is between Bhante's presentation of the Dharma and your own. Well, like you were saying, you had your own experience, you had your own intuitive sense. And, you know, Saramatti talks about the Buddha's enlightenment as this experience, and then what he describes as the conceptual backfilling.
Mm-hmm.
The Dharma as being the conceptual backfilling for the Buddha's experience. And that's absolutely, in a way, congruent with what you were saying earlier. And I find it quite interesting thinking, oh, if somebody's mind doesn't work in that way with that kind of intuition, what's that like? And
right.
That was where that question came from. Mm.
You know, we were talking just now about sort of the need for extra teaching and so on.
Mm.
I'm reminded of, there was, I can't remember her name, but there was a woman who wrote about a long retreat in the Himalayas. She was involved with the Tibetan tradition. Was it Cave in the Snow?
Oh, yeah. And Tenzin Palmo,
yeah. I think it was her who said that she'd once met some sort of elite yogis, you know, sort of a cooler of these sort of very highly renowned yogis who were all practicing up in the mountains and so on. And she wanted to know what sort of advanced teachings they'd received. And they thought that this was quite hilarious. And said that, no, we've got exactly the same teachings as you and everyone else. The only difference is we practice them. And I thought that was really good.
Mm.
And I tell you what, it's coming out, I was reading in the Pali Canon, there's a sutta, I can't remember the number or the name of it, but... you know, there's a sort of setup, and then the Buddha's talking about all the different kinds of spiritual aspirations that people might have. Like they might want magical things, like they might want to be able to remember their past births or see where other people have been reborn or fly through mountains or all these sorts of things. And he's saying, well, for all of the, you know, all of these, what you need to do is practice the precepts, deepen your meditation and gain insight. It's not exactly that, but something like that. And then he goes through all the other more refined and more sophisticated sort of aims that people might have in their spiritual lives, to which he gives exactly the same answer all the way through. So to me, that's sort of, you know, that, basically that's what it's all about, following the precepts, deepening your meditation and seeing the emptiness of things, seeing the emptiness of greed, hatred and illusion. So I don't think, you know, in a way you don't need a lot more teaching than the very basic teaching. I suppose one does need inspiration. You know, you need to be, every now and again, it's nice to have things expressed in a different way so that you can sort of gain some inspiration from it.
And I was wondering about Shraddha. If that's not the quite a crucial...
Oh, yeah.
That's the reason why the yogis are just keep doing it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. How would you describe your relationship with the experience of Shraddha?
My relation to it. What do you mean?
How do you understand it? It manifests, or how do you understand it, or?
Well, for me, it's just a deepening confidence, just more and more confidence. Do you know, like if I went back to the time when I first met Banti, I had this vague feeling of something, but I didn't know what it was. I could very easily have put it aside and, you know, grown up, got a job, got married, settled down, done all the rest of the stuff. Just lost confidence in it. But what's happened over the years is I've got more and more confident in the, if you like, the existence of the Buddha and the kind of the effectiveness of the Dharma and the sort of the joy of the Sangha, really. I mean, those things have just got sort of... I've just got more and more confident in them. I would say that's what I feel has changed in my life. You know, if there was ever going to be any measure of how far I develop spiritually, that's what I'd use, my confidence, how far my confidence in the Dharma has developed. And, as you know, in a way, I suppose you could say, well, that's why I regard Banti as more developed, because he's always exhibited this, you know, unshakable confidence in the Dharma, and his confidence has helped me develop mine.
How would you describe your day-to-day practice at the moment?
Well, I am engaged with my meditation practice. And what I'm particularly engaged with at the moment is trying to see what's going on in my mind, particularly when my thoughts stop. So what happens then is a sort of all sorts of kind of, I suppose images is the best way to describe it, arise in my mind that seem, I don't know, I've certainly not created them consciously, they just appear, can be faces or landscapes, or sometimes just sort of a sensation in my body is at a different angle, or or that physical sensation, but all of these kind of, I suppose, non-verbal events that are happening in my mind, and I'm just interested in them. I've got interested in them. And so when I meditate, that's kind of what I'm interested in. So that's my meditation. Because I'm living alone on the boat, I'm going through quite a lot of sort of feelings about well, friendship, relationships to people. And I'm just sort of staying with that, trying to be aware of all of that. And I'm particularly interested in trying to perform acts of kindness and generosity, particularly mentally. So those I've kind of identified metta recently as an action rather than a feeling. So, I mean, I know we always say this, don't we? But for somehow it's become more real recently. So I tend to think, well, you know, what may I perform some kind act for someone or some generous act for someone? And so I'm sort of, my ethical work's going on in that kind of area of just trying to, trying to do that. I'm kind of quite consciously involved in doing that. And also, as an Anagarika, what I consider the most crucial thing about Anagarika is remaining sort of emotionally independent. And living on the boat, I'm experiencing that emotional independence, sometimes a bit sort of painfully, but sometimes quite as a liberation as well. So I'm again sort of being aware of that and thinking about that, thinking of that. One aspect of that is that I do want to maintain a connection with my spiritual friends. So I'm also quite consciously making an effort to do that as well.
If you look back over the last, 45 years, or I guess it's 45 years or so, like a landscape, are there any particular things stand out for you, looking back over that time in the order?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things I've been, because of the way I've been approaching my meditation, at the moment I'm thinking quite a lot along the lines that meditation is a non-narrative experience. You know, things come into your mind, they don't follow a nice, neat narrative. When you think back over your life, you've got a narrative, and you tend to think in terms of my history. You know, I was there, and then I was there, and then I was there, and I did this and this and this, and these things all sort of follow on. So I tell the story of my life in that way. So if I look at it in that way, I suppose it's sort of, I think of the places where I was. You know, I was in London, chaotic, painful, Cornwall, wonderful, blissful, started my first centre, which was, you know, in a small way, moderately successful. And then London, working with the LBC, very difficult, very painful. Then off to the States, very difficult, but very, very satisfying, very deeply satisfying. Coming back to England, working at Papaloka, think of that, which was wonderful, you know, that was fantastic. Going to Guhuloka was even more wonderful, running courses there. And then looking after my dad, which was sort of quite difficult, But I'm glad I did it. And then now I'm into my sort of new phase. So I see it in those. Is that the sort of thing you meant? Or?
Just interesting sense of what the landscape looks like, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, there could be another ones where I looked at my relationship to the order. So, which would be not always straightforward, actually. I found it really difficult being around the community, you know, the friends in the early days. I think probably because I'm quite sort of individualistic and I didn't want to get sort of, as I would see it then, absorbed into the group in a way. So that's why I went off to live in Cornwall, which I really enjoyed. Being by myself in Cornwall was wonderful. But then I started meeting people there, and so I over the years I've always had this struggle about being part of the movement and, you know, being more kind of individualistic.
That's interesting, because I think that was the same thing that I was picking up with this conversation with Arnold and Marlene, like I was saying about the kind of going off thing.
Mm.
So there's something about the individual in relationship to the group there, isn't there?
Yeah.
So sorry, you were saying you got as far as
Well, there's been a few landmarks actually in that particular struggle. The first of which really was when I was in London in the late 70s. I'd come back from Cornwall to London, and there were various kind of, you know, views and opinions in the order around that time that I really didn't subscribe to and I really didn't like.
What sort of thing?
Well, it was the great separation between men and women, really. And I was... I didn't want to see that happen. I think because I was very, very attached to having women around, you know, I didn't want to see. I was afraid we might develop a monastic wing or something like that, which I'm now very happy about. But at that time, it was really, I found that quite difficult. Mm. I also found sort of it difficult being kind of immersed in the group in a way. Anyway, it got to a crisis point. I mean, and it was a real crisis. I mean, it was really an existential crisis, extremely painful, where I felt, well, either I don't want to just be a member of this group, but on the other hand, what else am I going to do? You know, this is the best sort of movement I've found, but there's certain things about it I really just don't like. I can't subscribe to it. I can't sort of... So there was this conflict, you know, do I leave it, do I stay, so on. And in the end, to cut a long story short, I decided that I wasn't going to have anything more to do with the FWBO. However, what I would do is I'd draw up a list of the individuals that I felt a spiritual rapport with. You know, I felt this kind of spiritual connection. So I'd draw up that list and, you know, not surprisingly, they were all order members. But I changed my attitude. From then on, I would relate to those people, not to the group. So I felt myself, how I described it at the time, as I was part of a network rather than part of a group in a mathematical sense. You know, a group is you draw a circle around things with common qualities, characteristics, whereas a network, you've got these different individual nodes joined by bonds of friendship. So I was quite happy to be part of a network, but I wasn't happy to be part of a group. And that was a big shift in my understanding of the nature of the order. And I've stuck with that ever since. So that was one big landmark. The next was when I moved to the... Well, this is a smaller landmark, but when I moved to the States, I was away from my friends. You know, I wasn't having regular contact with, but I felt closer to them than I had done when I'd been in England. Because I think at that, at a distance, your relationship becomes, well, it becomes more principial. So you relate on the basis of what is really most important, which was our spiritual connection, our spiritual friendship. Whereas when we came together, there were all sorts of kind of superficial personality things which were sort of pounded up against each other. So I realised that, you know, it was, there was something that my spiritual friends, friendships were, went below the surface, and they could often be disturbed by sort of personality issues. So I needed always to look deeper. And then the third one was about 10 years after that, when I'd been working to set up the various institutions in the States. And I decided I wanted to back off from that. I wanted to be a bit more independent and not be involved with institutions. At the same time, a lot of messages coming from England were stressing the importance of working within the context of the institutions. And there was even, for a while, there was this idea that taking responsibility within the movement was equivalent to spiritual development, in a way. And I just thought, well, no, I don't go along with that. And being at such a distance and experiencing this, and so it's almost like the movement was going off over to the right and I was going to the left. Mm-hmm. You know, this was all about, to the right was all about institutions and developing the movement, and I was wanting to go off, be more by myself again. The sort of individualist side was coming up, and I thought, well, maybe there's no place for me, you know, in this movement. So it was, again, it was another sort of struggle between the my experience of the order as a group and my desire to sort of be individual. Anyway, then Bhante wrote a review of Reginald Gray's book on Buddhist saints in India, in which he talked about these three sort of sections of the Sangha. And I thought, fine, there is a place for me. You know, within the Sangha, there is a place for people who don't fit into the institutions. So that resolved it again. And then when I came back to England, I found actually that I could, you know, I could work within the institutions at Padmaloka and at Kihaloka without actually feeling institutionalized, or that I, you know, that I was having to work, that I was having to go against myself in any way. And I think probably now I'm doing it again on another level, because the order now is so sort of big and complex, and there's people within the order living lives that frankly I can't understand. So how do I relate to this order now? It's a new challenge.
It does sound resonant with what you just described, doesn't it?
Yeah. With what?
What you were describing earlier about the group and the network.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Actually, I think that's a good point. You know, it's almost like whenever I hear the order described as a group, it upsets me, because I don't want it thought of in that way. Mm. You know, I mean, some people have said recently, you know, that people haven't been allowed by, the order hasn't allowed people to think in certain ways. Well, that to me is group, that's groupthink. That's, the order just doesn't function like that. You know, so it's sort of, yeah, I suppose it does. That doesn't correspond to my understanding of what the order is.
So how would you say it does function if it doesn't function like that?
Well, I think the order how does it function? It doesn't function like that. Yeah, I think it's based on individual connections. You know, it's a network of individuals who are connected by their commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. They're going for refuge. These days I'm thinking a lot in terms of the Mahasangha, if you like, the Maha order, and a specific order. So the Mahasangha, you could say, is the universal network of individuals connected by their common going for refuge. And, you know, I'm a member of that. So is Milarepa. You know, so is Kukai. We're all part of that Mahasangha. But given the sort of constraints of time, geography, and all the rest of it, you also belong to a particular Sangha. So the Sangha that I belong to is the one that has arisen from Sangharakshita's understanding of the Dharma. So that there were individuals who linked to him, you know, as part of that network. And there are people that are linked to those individuals. So that the part, the section of the network that directly relates back to Sangharakshita is what I would call our order. Yeah. And as long as those connections are strong and valid, then personally, that's all I believe you need to identify the order. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes complete sense.
Am I stating the obvious?
No, I think you're being clear about something that isn't necessarily that obvious.
Yeah. I mean, I've got friends, particularly people that when I was in the States, I met a lot of people from a lot of other Buddhist traditions and really got on well with them, respected them, and developed friendships with some of them, spiritual friendships with some of them. So those are part of my network. But they're not part of my order because they don't go back to Sangharakshita. And that's fine for me, you know, it's sort of... but I do, and each of those would have their own order, where they feel that their lineage goes back to it. It's almost like you can trace your lineage, can't you? So if you, you know, you ask any particular order member who it is that's inspired them particularly to, you know, in their practice and their vision and so on. Then you go to those people and ask them. And then go to those people. And eventually it should come back to Sangharakshita. If that connection's there, then I think that's what makes the order.
I mean, something I was saying to Ananda and Marlene earlier, I don't quite found a way to put it, but it's something about looking from this perspective now, back over the last 45, 50 years, what matters? It's a bit abstract as a question, but maybe it's just what could, another way to put it would be, what other questions do you think we need to be asking each other in the course of these conversations?
I'll tell you what I think. I know what I think matters.
Mm.
What matters is the vision, the insight, the kind of the spiritual vision. That's really what matters. And the rest of it doesn't really. Do you know, for me, it's that initial thing that got me linked to Bhante that is the most important thing. And he's part of that because he kind of gave me the ability to connect with it, to grasp it. Not always very purely.
Say not.
Well, you know, you get... I do think that strand of the Dharma has run through my life, actually. Mm. I think that's true. But I've also got involved with other things as well.
Such as?
Well, wine, women and song, really, except not not wine and not song.
So how would you describe that strand of your life?
Oh, I like my relationships I've had with women. I'm really quite attached to women I have been. And so I've always had a girlfriend, well, until 17 years ago, I always had a girlfriend and always saw a girlfriend as very much part of my life. And I don't think that was directly connected to my vision. So, you know, I invested time and energy and got a lot out of it, actually. I mean, I enjoyed my relationships. But I don't think that was directly connected with my vision.
And what do you think Bunty made of that?
Well, he was very surprised when I said I would become an Anagarika. He did once say to me that he thought that he named two order members, one of whom was me and one was somebody else, who would, he thought would never become Anagarikas because we liked our women too much.
Did he ever try and dissuade you from that?
No. He used to make fun of me.
In what way?
Don't know if I can think of specific examples now. No, I can't remember. No, I think he probably used to pull my leg a bit though. It was a very lively sort of period, actually. 70s, yeah, 70s generally, 60s, 70s. I think it was a kind of, even into the 80s, actually. Do you know, I mean, people have said, well, you know, Sangraksha said it was a period of experimentation from him, from the late 60s to the early mid 80s. Isn't that rather a long time to experiment? But actually, it was, you know, we were experimenting all sorts of different things in life then. It was really exciting. And, you know, like, I've regarded it as a sort of bohemian experiment.
Mm.
It was a kind of, a countercultural experiment. And the thing about bohemian experiments is they create a lot of really new ideas and they create a lot of difficulty and pain as well. I mean, look at the romantics, the Pre-Raphaelites, and sort of what to call them in the 1920s.
Bloomsbury.
Look at the Beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they introduced a lot of very interesting ideas into our culture. But you know, Coleridge was a opium addict, and Shelley died young after creating chaotic relationships with his women. Byron was, you know, creating all sorts of problems everywhere. So it's out of those milieus comes a lot of very, very, very good things, which have influenced us for hundreds of years later.
Mm.
But I mean, there was a lot of pain and difficulty and loss as well in them. And I suppose I see our early days as actually more in that tradition. And so, And I would make no apologies for any of it, really. You know, you do things like that, all sorts of stuff happens.
Mm. Mm.
But I was glad to be part of it.
We haven't talked about how you came to be part of it, to go right back to the beginning.
Well, we have really. I mean, I was searching for something.
Well, I meant literally the first.
The specifics.
Yeah.
Well, I was married to Dharmadina, Sheila, as she then was, and she wanted to do some yoga, learn yoga. So we went along to a yoga class. The woman leading the yoga class was Penny Neal Smith, who was an order member named Tara, though nobody knew that. And she invited us to a retreat down at Kefalds. So Dhammadinner and I went down for the weekend. But man, we kind of bowled over really. And then we went back the following weekend. And then in summer went to the full retreat. And in between we'd started going to Sakura for the last several months that Sakura was there.
So it was at Kefalds you first met Bunty?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do, yeah, yeah. He was back from America, because this was when he was doing this whole seminar thing at Yale. And he was back for the retreat. And he wasn't well. He was very sick, actually. I think he had bronchitis. I think he might even have had pneumonia, actually. He was really bad. But he was around. He was present. We listened to the Vision and Transformation series on tape. With him sitting there. And, I learned the mindfulness breathing and Metta-Bhavana. Learned those from Dhammapala. And Bhante personally didn't particularly impress me. We were pretty grubby, but I thought he was even grubbier. So old. Old robe and long hair and fistful of silver rings and that, it was that era, and he was, not easily approachable particularly. But the talk was fantastic. It was utterly astounding. Yeah, and never looked back really.
So was it that talk when you realised he knew what your experience was?
Yeah, this whole talk about vision and transformation made so much sense of what I was trying to do. I don't know, if it had been a different talk, it might have been different, but that series really encapsulated exactly what I was looking for. Now, I suppose I wasn't converted by Bhante, I sort of discovered, it's like, in a way, I already knew what I was looking for. Bhante's expression, he discovered he was a Buddhist and always had, it's a little bit actually like that.
Mm.
I didn't become something new. It was like, this was what I was, this was what sort of, what I was deep down, what resonated with.
Mm. It's back to that thing of following what's emerged, quotes, from within.
Yeah.
Which is so clear. I've just been rereading The Rainbow Road.
Yeah.
And he's going around India, going to all these Hindu teachers and following what speaks to him, because he's not learning from the teachers. He's using the teachers to unfold what it is that's coming from him, which is what I hear you saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've covered a fair bit of ground,
haven't we? Yeah, some of what I've said is kind of thinking in progress as well, which is not so clear, I think. But anything useful there, do you reckon?
I think there's a lot, actually. I think it's hit the nail on the head for me.
Good.